This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Some people have called Sharon Jones a female James Brown. She grew up in his hometown of Augusta, Georgia, and imitated him as a child. Now, she sings with the band The Dap Kings. She was described in the New York Times as a timeless soul singer, and The Dap Kings were described as obsessive and skillful soul revivalists. The band backed Amy Winehouse on several tracks of her hit album Back to Black, and also backed her on her first U.S. tour. Our guests today are Sharon Jones and the founder of the Dap Kings, Gabriel Roth, a.k.a. Bosco Mann. They met when he co-owned the now-defunct label Desco Records and asked her to record for it. Now, Roth runs Daptone Records, which recently released the fourth album by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. It's called I Learned the Hard Way. Here's the title track.
Something told me inside that your love was untrue.
Something told me inside. Something told me inside.
You said, girl, it's all right. I would never hurt you.
You said, girl, it's all right. You said, girl, it's all right.
Just to be by your side, I would have walked through the flames.
Just to be by your side. Just to be by your side.
Terry Gross spoke with Sharon Jones and Gabriel Roth in 2007.
How would you describe the sound you're going after?
More of a soul, stacked 68, 69 sound. Gabe?
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, I've always just tried to make records that sound like the records I like. I never had too much of a very specific agenda that we were going to try to ape something or try to pass something off. We just wanted to make records that felt good to us and sounded good to us.
Gabe, would you describe the instrumentation of the band and what you patterned it on?
The instrumentation of the band is drums, bass, two guitar players, baritone and tenor saxophones, a trumpet, percussion, and Sharon singing.
Is it hard to find good baritone players who aren't full-time jazz musicians now?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing about this band is that it really is a band, and I think it's rare for a band to be this big and actually be a band. It's a bunch of guys that are really part of it. We're not using sidemen. We're not changing people out every gig. You know, I mean, once in a while, people have to sub out for something. But as far as baritone players, man, we have Ian Hendrickson-Smith, who is actually a very talented and accomplished jazz musician in his own right, both on tenor and alto and baritone, and has put out a lot of records in his own name. But he's a real barker in the band. I think for the horn player specifically, I mean, it's a good point you brought up. Horn players are used to coming from more of a kind of jazz mercenary background. That just tends to be the culture around horn players as opposed to guitar players and stuff. But these are guys that really, really can feel the power and the energy of playing in a section and being part of a whole. And I think it's that way for the whole band. You really have guys that are not coming into it with ego, but are coming into it with, with the idea of everybody, you know, playing a part together and achieving something that nobody can achieve individually. And I think that's something that's really refreshing, especially coming out of certain circumstances sometimes in jazz where people are more sidemen or just coming in to play solos and things like that.
James Brown has obviously been a big influence on each of you. I'd like you to each talk about the influence of James Brown on you. Sharon, let's start with you.
Well, with me, just, I guess, being born in his hometown and my parents, I found out later, my mother knew him. They used to play together. My father knew him.
Your mother used to play with James Brown?
Yeah, like in Augusta, there's something like they used to, some kind of way they cross paths, is going somewhere, doing something, you know. Oh, yeah, you know.
Wait, do you mean play music with him or just like play as
no,
a kid?
No, I mean,
like,
they was young, you know, when he was out there doing his thing, like in front of the the record store, before he owned anything, when he was still dancing and shining shoes and making money, that type of thing. You know, they knew each other from coming up. And I my Uncle Willie told me that he was like, my father used to, like, tap with James Brown. He used to dance out on the streets. I was like, wow, you know, so... I don't, you know, you never know these things. You know, when the older people get up and they start talking sometime, and I just found all this out like last year. So I'm like, well, I haven't heard this before. So, you know, I'll let that go. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Uncle Willie just wanted to be talking, but, you know, but still, I know that they did grow up. And once he was performing somewhere in Augusta, and I think I was maybe 9, 10, or maybe, you know, younger, and I went to see him. And something happened. He was on the stage, and I looked at his foot, and all I remember saying to my father, I turned around, told someone, like, he's floating. His foot, he's not even touching the floor. And I was, like, right at the stage, eye level to James Brown's foot and feet, and I couldn't tell if that man, it was like he was floating. And that's an experience that I just remember, that experience with James. And then the next was when I saw him last year, April, in Italy, right before, you know. And he was a little weak, and I got to take the picture, and I was trying to get word in to him. Oh, Mr. Brown, you know, my name is Sharon Jones with the Dap Kings, and, you know. And he was like, looked me right in the eye and said, God bless you, daughter. And, and that was it, and, you know.
So what influence has James Brown had on you as a singer and just as a stage performer?
Well, basically, with Daptone, when I met them, it was like, it sounds so much like it reminded me of James Brown and JB's, that music. And then I knew where they was coming from with me singing. And I guess just doing the music, hearing the music, and always around these guys playing the JBs and the James Brown thing, and I fit right in. I guess I was that female James Brown, that the sound.
Well, while we're talking about James Brown, you know, James Brown was often introduced on stage in this, like, great hyperbolic way. And you... I know have done that on record. I don't know if you do that for all the shows. But why don't we play the introduction from the first Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings album. And this will give a taste of what I mean. Here it comes.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daptone Super Soul Review. My name is Benji Griptite, and we are the Dap Kings. Thank you very much. Right now, for your enjoyment and pleasure, we would like to introduce to you the funky and dynamic sister who is exciting dance floors across the nation with her dynamic new sound. Soul brothers and sisters from coast to coast get up and get down whenever her records are played. They're doing all the funky new dances. They're doing the bump and touch. They're doing the dap dip. Everything. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about 110 pounds of soul excitement coming for you. This sister is so bad, she's badder than bad. I'm talking about the same sister that brought you such hits as The Landlord. Damn, it's hot. Ain't it hot? Bang! And now, ladies and gentlemen, the star of our show, the super soul sister with the magnetic je ne sais quoi, Miss Sharon Jones!
That's the introduction from the first Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings album. God, can you guys do that for me, like when I host Fresh Air?
that would just be so great to have that kind of introduction. I'll tell you, you got to hire Binky Griptite, man. Binky Griptite has been a very integral part of our whole operation for the last, you know, dozen years. You know, and he's not just, I mean, he's a great guitar player, but just as far as showmanship, he's kind of the guy that, as an MC, kind of brings the show to another level as far as our live show, you know. And he's definitely inspired, not just by James Brown, but by Danny Ray, who always used to introduce James Brown.
Does this help you really get in the mood to be on stage, hearing that build
up? Oh, yes, it does. I mean, when I'm behind the stage and Binky out there doing one with the magnetic, I can't even say that, magnetic, je ne sais quoi, whatever.
Magnetic, je ne sais
quoi. Yeah, and I'm this back there. And they're just screaming, and it's like, Miss Sharon, Miss. You know, I get so hyped. You know, the blood start pumping. I feel like I'm getting ready to go on to a Rocky show, head for the ring, you know, get ready to get in the boxing ring.
You know, the live show we do is real different from the records,
you know. Yeah,
and
definitely.
We don't try to do the same thing in the studio as we do on stage and vice versa, because it works differently. But as far as the live show, it is really influenced not just by James Brown, but by Stax and all the other kind of soul reviews that were going on in the late 60s. There's a sense of showmanship in that and excitement that you don't see in a lot of shows nowadays. And you know, we kind of do it's not formulaic, but it's very similar. We usually start with some instrumentals, and then maybe Binky will sing a few songs, and we kind of get the crowd going, and he'll talk to the crowd and get them, you know, so kind of build up the suspense, and then he gets into this huge intro. And that was, I mean, the one that you just heard, that was from what, 5-6 years ago or something, right? So that was about 7 years ago.
Yeah.
So now it's a lot more hooked up. You know, band is settled in, and there's a lot of fireworks in the show. You know, and Sharon's coming out, and the band's blasting, and we're cutting from one song to another, and you know, so in that way, it's exciting.
Sharon, I've got a few questions for you, and then Gabe, I've got a few questions for you. And Gabe, feel free to jump in if there's something you want to add to what Sharon says here. First of all, actually, I got a question for both of you, which is, how did you find each other?
Well, Gabe was looking. He was looking for 3 background singers to do some vocals for Lee Fields. And my ex used to play the saxophone with the Doctaries, with the guys when they was you know, sole providers, and he was like, well, my lady sing. And they were like, the lady sing? And I said, yeah, I could do all 3 parts. So when I went in, Gabe heard me, everything worked, everyone was happy.
And then we ended up cutting 2 more songs that day with you singing lead.
Yeah, that's right. Switchblade
and the landlord I believe.
Yeah.
There's a great story I'd like you to tell, Gabe, about recording Sharon doing a track that was intended for a man. The track was called Switchblade. Tell us the story.
Well, originally Sharon, just like she said, she'd come into the studio just to sing backgrounds. And there were 2 tracks on this album that we wanted backgrounds for. One was the one for Lee Fields, which she nailed in a second, did all 3 parts, blew me away. All of a sudden, it was the first thing I ever did that sounded like a record to me. And then there was this other song called Switchblade, and there was this guy, this kind of comedian friend we had that wanted to do this whole long kind of, you know, this whole long talking rap. Well, when I say rap, I mean, you know, he's just talking about, oh, I just got out of prison, I'm going to cut you with my switchblade. And then Sharon would come in with,
Switchblade.
Yeah, so she cut all those background vocals, you know, and she was having a gas. Anyway, while I was cutting the last track of backing vocals, she just started talking smack, and we were rolling on the floor. It was much funnier than the guy who was going to do it. So I just rewound the tape real quick and just told her to go for it. And I ran the tape at a little bit higher speed so she was trying to do kind of a low voice anyway. So I just ran the tape a little bit fast for her. And she just went through the whole thing, I'm going to slit you where the good Lord split you, and all the whole thing. And she went off for about 3-4 minutes straight.
Just talking. Yeah.
And just in one take. And that was, man, we had a gas. That was actually, it was strange because that was really the first lead vocal that we cut together. And it wasn't really a vocal. She was just talking smack. But, you know, it was something, it was kind of my first glimpse into the kind of personality and the kind of wit that, and the charisma that she had that, you know, enabled her to kind of create an entire show sometimes out of, you know, people just staring at her and she's just talking nonsense sometimes and people are having a blast, you know. And, you know, after that we did a bunch of 45s and eventually an album and another album and here we are.
Well, Switchblade is really hard to find. It's out of print, but fortunately, you have a copy for us to hear. So why don't we listen to it?
I done told you to get away from me. Don't make me cut you with this switchblade. I'll cut you up. I cut you up bad. I cut you so bad your mama won't know you. Just step away now. I'll slit you where the good Lord split you double, twice, and 3 times more. Just get on away from here now. Don't make me slice you. Don't make me slice you, 'cause I'm fast and I'm bad. Now you talking about grooving? Grooving? The only thing that's gonna be grooving is blood gonna be flying when I finish slicing you up now. Move on away now. Step on back. Yeah, now. Move on away in. That's why they call me.
So that's Switchblade with my guest Sharon Jones, recorded so she could be slowed down and sound like a man. And my guests are Sharon Jones, who's the lead singer of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and Gabriel Roth, who's the founder of the band, the lead songwriter and the bass player. So Sharon, I know you spent some time as a prison guard at Rikers Island. Did you record this rap before or after you held that job?
after.
So you had inspiration for this?
Oh, yeah, I was ready. I think maybe that's why when I went in, it was so sharp. Everything just came real fast, you know. And actually, I remember when I went in the studio, they asked the question, pretend, you know, some guy, you know, like, you know, a bad guy would cut you so fast with a razor, you know, back in the day, just talking smack, like in an alley or something. So that's when I went to that, a junkyard dog, tuck his tail under the run when he see me coming. And it was all just like spurred. I mean, just the words just flew out. It was like, I didn't even think of what I was saying, concentrating on, I just went with it.
While we're on the subject, how did you get the job as a prison guard at Rikers Island in New York?
Oh, I took the test. I took a lot of tests at that time. I took the police test.
What's the test like? I mean, what you really need to do is to be able to, you know,
get
people to respect you. How do you pass a test on that?
They give you a psychological test, you know, the physical test you have to go through, a little background check on you, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was great. I think I would have still been there, but it just took me away from my singing, you know, the music. It was like a career. And after being in there, it was like an omen. My first week, they stuck me outside, and I pulled a groin muscle on the side. I fell. Then I came back, and I was in a, believe it or not, it's so weird, a car accident. A truck hit me, and I was out for another, like, 9 months. And they forced me back to work. And the same day I came to work, I had a back brace, a neck brace, you know, and I'm walking on and fell on the curb. So now I'm injured again.
No.
But now I'm telling you, it wasn't meant for me. I fell on the job. Now it's comp, and I'm out again for another couple of months. And so when I finally came in, they said, you know, the lawyer said, why don't you just resign? This way they won't fire you. And so I resigned for medical reasons.
So how many days did you actually work?
Okay, I'll say out of the 2 years, from 88 to 90, maybe 6-8 months.
So when you were there, given how you kept injuring yourself and you weren't in the best physical shape, how were you able to convince the prisoners that you were strong enough and focused enough to do the job and keep them in line?
I may tell you, if the look in my eyes, you may have like 80 inmates to maybe three officers or two officers. So it was really weird, but you could not show fear. And that's one thing I didn't show, you know, and I got the respect from them right there, and they knew that I didn't take stuff. I wasn't scared.
Let's hear another track from Sharon Jones and the Daft Kings. And this song is called Humble Me. And this is another song, Gabe, that you wrote. Do you want to say anything about writing or recording this track?
Well, it's a very simple song. It wasn't much to write. It's just a couple of chords and some simple, heartfelt words that Sharon could really get into. I mean, the thing that I learned about writing is that, you know, I've never been a genius or anything, but I learned how to kind of get out of the way of great musicians and great singers. So, you know, if you listen to the song, there's not much to the writing in it, but I think Sharon puts a lot of heart into it, you know.
Actually, I think that song, you was writing something about me, the inside of me, but I think, you know, by knowing me all these years, Gabe knew that how I am at the church, I'm always saying, you know, I'm so thankful for what God gave me. So that's why I'm always saying, if you see me like I'm higher than everybody else, you know, bring me down. Let me know I'm not. If you see me up here wanting all these here fancy things, which he know they don't never see me out here flashing and wanting stuff. But if you see me doing that, I want all these shoes that cost $2,000, $3,000. Think about that man over there who don't even have the foot is cut off, you know, don't even have legs, you know. And then I'm also thankful, humble for when I'm on the road. People come out and pay to come and see me. And I get on that stage, and I'm humble for them coming out to see me every night. And I'm so thankful for them, for God, for having me to be able to dance and jump and sing and keep my voice open. So that song is just about me thanking God, being humble for my blessings.
All right. Well, here it is. Sharon Jones and the Daft Kings, Humble Me, from their CD, 100 Days, 100 Nights.
Don't let me forget who I am.
That's Humble Me by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, produced by Gabriel Roth. They have a new CD called I Learned the Hard Way. They'll both be back, continuing their conversation with Terry, in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Let's continue Terry's 2007 conversation with singer Sharon Jones and Gabriel Roth, the leader of the band The Dap Kings. Their new CD, produced by Roth, is called I Learned the Hard Way. Here's another track from it.
I'm a better woman than I have been, 'cause I don't think about way back when. It takes two to love, but only one to leave. It was you who did that dirty deed. I got better things to do, better things to do, better things to do than remember you. I got better things to do, better things to do, better things to do than remember you.
Gabe, now, you write songs under the name Bosco Man, and you perform under the name Bosco Man. Where does that name come from, and why did you feel like you needed to have a stage name?
Well, it's very different now than when we started making records. We first started making records, it was a very different kind of business for us. We were, you know, I was about 19, 20 years old, and we were really into these old records, and we would make kind of these fake old records, you know, reissues of a sound. The first record album we did was a reissue of a soundtrack to a kung fu movie that never existed. You know, we just kind of made this stuff up, and so we were just having a blast making things up and putting them out, and people were buying them. And then we said, oh, great, man, people really like this music. So we started using, you know, we'd do a real name and say, okay, this is a new record we just recorded, and nobody was interested. We couldn't give them away. So we got kind of more into those fake things, and we did a lot. Man, we all used a lot of fake names, man. We did, you know, fake sitar records and African records, all different kinds of stuff with all kinds of crazy names. But really, and once I got deeper into it, I had another problem, which was that the first record label that we had going, Desco Records, was funded a lot by credit cards and, you know, other people that I'd borrowed money from. So once we did start selling records, I was real worried about putting my real name on any of them, because I had so many collections. I mean, I was sleeping on somebody's floor, and I was paying so much money to credit card companies every month, and so many people coming down on me trying to take money. I just didn't want to put my real name on anything. But, you know, in the long run, it actually worked out well, because, you know, when I'm on the road and somebody comes up to me and they say, hey, Bosco, it's good to see you again, I know right away this is not somebody I'm real close to. So I can say, hey, it's good to see you too, and I don't have to try to remember who they are. But,
so how'd you come up with the name?
Well, the Bosco part of it, actually, my dad wanted to name me Hieronymus after Hieronymus Bosch, and was going to call me Bosco for short. And my mom wouldn't let him do it, so eventually he named his dog Bosco. But so that was for him. And the man part of it was one of the first two records we did. There was a guitar player named Scott Mann that played on the record, and you know he used his real name Scott Mann. I just thought it'd be cool to have some brothers in the rhythm section, so I said, yeah, I'll be his brother. I'll be Bosco Mann. But yeah, I didn't really think that much of it. You know, it's always the things that you don't really think out too much that end up explaining for years.
Right. But,
one of the things that the Dap Kings are known for is that in your studio, you don't use digital recording technology. You use reel-to-reel tapes. You used to record on vinyl. But anyways, you shy away from, like, the new digital technology. Why? Like, what do you hear? What kind of sound can you get on analog that you feel you can't get on digital?
I mean, there's a lot of differences, but the main difference, I mean, the thing is, I've had a lot of technical, very often engineers or producers or something will try to, you know, will engage me in these very technical conversations about what gear you're using, what kind of mics or what kind of tape machines. But really, you know, my answer every time, which is you know, is not trying to be modest or anything, but just being truthful, is that really 99% of what's in a record is what's coming out of the musicians. And I think that the arrangements and the sound the musicians have on their instruments, that, you know, Dave Guy on the trumpet and Tommy playing guitar and Homer Steinweiss playing drums, these guys, they all of them, the whole band, everybody's got a sound on their instrument. And they actually sound like that. And a lot of people think I'm doing some crazy studio tricks, but really most of it is them. As far as that last 1%, I think that there's a lot of disadvantages to modern approaches to recording. One of them is that they tend to approach everything digitally with as many tracks as possible. With everything's recorded to a computer, so you can hit undo. If somebody's recording a solo, you can have them record it 35 times and then take the best notes from them. And if they say, "Oh, well, you think that was good?" Well, I don't know. Maybe try it again, and we'll see. When you're recording to like an 8-track tape machine, you're recording mostly live, and things are being mixed together. And if somebody goes back and they say, "Man, I don't know about that solo I played," you know, I look them in the eye and say, "Hey, are you going to play it better than that?" And they either have to say yes or no. And you need great musicians to go back in there and either play it better or not. And I mean, there's definitely good sound out of the tape. You know, the sound of recording to tape has a certain compression and a certain warmth that's desirable. But I don't think that's a huge part of what we're doing. I think it has much more to do with the approach of the musicians and just the approach of recording, just the you know, the strategy of it.
So one more question before we have to end. I haven't had the pleasure of seeing you on stage, only of listening to the recording. So what do you look like, all of you, on stage? How do you dress? I mean, some of the solo reviews you're talking about, like, really loud clothes.
I don't think it's loud, but you could get you tell. Come on.
Well, no, we keep it sharp. Everybody's got suits and ties and shine shoes and locked in step, man. The horn section's got some unbelievable steps. The band is always stepping together and playing together. And Sharon always looks unbelievable. She comes out and is usually a blur from the beginning of the show to the end. You've never seen something move so much. So, visually, it's definitely an event, too.
I guess those injuries from your prison guard days aren't holding you back.
No, they're not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to both of you for talking with us. It's really been fun. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Singer Sharon Jones and producer Gabriel Roth. Their newest album, by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, is called I Learned the Hard Way. Our next guest, superstar basketball player LeBron James of the Cleveland Cavaliers, has made headlines almost every day this week for different reasons. He's been voted the league's MVP for the second year in a row. He was just named to the All-NBA first team for the third year in a row. And he's playing in the playoffs right now with an injured elbow. James and the Cavaliers are tied with the Boston Celtics at a game apiece, and Game 3 is tonight. LeBron James has been a sports star ever since he was on the cover of Sports Illustrated at the age of 17 when he was still in high school. He was the number one NBA draft pick out of high school, and at 19, he became the youngest rookie of the year in NBA history. James told his story in his memoir, Shooting Stars, now out in paperback. James, who was raised in Akron, Ohio by his single mother, also is the focus of More Than a Game, a documentary, now out on DVD, about the tight bond between James and his closest childhood friends, who shared not only a love of basketball, but also a level of trust. James has known Drew Joyce, Shion Cotton, and Willie McGee since junior high, and Romeo Travis since high school. They all talk about their friendship in this clip from More Than a Game.
We had a natural feel for each other. I'm not sure what it was. I guess it was just meant to be, but we had a chemistry for each other. It was basketball, but it was more friendship than anything.
We were all kind of like strangers, and we really bonded.
You know, I wanted to finally have some brothers that I can be loyal to and be trustworthy, and I think we all kind of shared that bond.
I just remember being over at LeBron's house one night, and they was just talking like, you and I are good friends, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it was weird for me for somebody to express themselves to me, including another dude, another boy to me like that, you know what I mean? Like, they was more giving, they was more accepting, you know what I'm saying? Just got more comfortable.
The 5'4", that was like our identity.
Terry Gross spoke with LeBron James last year.
LeBron James, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you remember the very first time that you dunked?
Yeah, I was in eighth grade, and my middle school every year has a teachers versus students game. You know, they play the basketball team, and in warm-ups, I have no idea what got into me, but it was so electric in this gym. I think this gym holds probably like, it holds probably like, I'd say probably about 45 people in there. That's a lot, right, for an eighth grade game, 45 people. And, it, you know, the crowd was, you know, the students is having a great time. And, you know, we got out of school early. And in the warm-ups, I just decided, I don't know, I was going to jump as high as I could and try to dunk. And I did it. You know, I went up and dunked the basketball. I don't know what got into me that day. And then when the game started, I got a breakaway and did it again, and the crowd went crazy. And that was like one of the best moments of my whole life.
You're one of the people who went very suddenly from poverty to wealth. You write in your book, you know, your mother had you when she was 16. Her mother died when you were 3. It was hard for your mother to support you. You had to keep moving a lot because of eviction notices and, you know, rent problems. Did you think of basketball as a way out, as more than just a game?
Well, I think it is more than a game. Basketball, and I think sport, period, gives you an opportunity to forget about anything that may be going on in your life, back away from that particular sport that you may be playing. You know, I definitely used the game to get my mind off some of the bad things that may have been going on as a child.
Like what?
You know, it's just things you never want your kids to see. You know, violence and things like that. You never want your kids to see that. So, you know, I used the game of basketball to keep me away from that.
Now, how did you meet the three players who, along with you, became known as the Fab Four? Three players that you went to junior high and high school with and became real winners together.
Well, I met Little Drew through the same Little League team, through the same league. It's the ARB, it's the Akron Recreation Bureau. And Little Drew just so happened played on our rival team. We was the Summer Lake Hornets, and he played for the Ed Davis Dream Team All-Stars. So we were rivals, and, you know, we met through that way. Willie played on my team. He played on the Summer Lake Hornets with me. And I met Romeo on the football team where I played before basketball on the East Dragons.
What was it about this group that made you work so well together? Like, what was, describe something about, like, the chemistry on and off the court that made you work like that?
Well, the chemistry off the court is why we were so good on the court. You know, we looked at each other as brothers. I mean, at the time it was the Fab Four. It was myself, Drew, Shion Cotton, and Willie McGee. And we, you know, we used that off-the-court friendship, that, you know, going to, I don't know, going to McDonald's together, playing basketball outside together, you know, driving to West Virginia to play in the AAU tournament, you know, things like that. And then when we got on the court, it was like, okay, this is the easy part.
Little Drew is called Little Drew because he was little. He was, yeah. Was like 5'3 or something when you were in high school?
Yeah, when we was a freshman, that's good for him. When we was a freshman, Drew was about 4'11". We
Whoa.
Were freshmen in high school. He came off the bench that year, our freshman year, and he was a heck of a shooter. And, you know, he was, anytime you left him open, he, for the most part, wasn't going to miss. And, you know, he did that from game one all the way to the last game of the season in the state championship.
So you, Drew, Willie McGee, and Shion Cotton wanted to go to the same high school together so that you could continue to be teammates. And you went to a high school that no one expected you to go to. Everybody expected you to go to, is it pronounced Buchtel?
Buchtel,
which, yep, which you describe as the school of choice for black athletes. It was a public school, but instead you went to a predominantly white Catholic school, St. Vincent's. Would you explain how you ended up, the four of you, going to St. Vincent's?
We ended up going to St. Vincent because Little Drew at the time, remember I told you he was only about 4'10", 4'11". He didn't think Buchtel was going to give him an equal opportunity to play for them. And when Drew realized that, you know, he was like, you know, I'm not going there. He had started going to this Sunday night clinic that our high school coach eventually, Keith Danbrough, was holding. And he seen how much confidence he had in Drew. And Drew was like, hey, I'm going to St. V, guys. And it was tough at first, you know, because we knew really nothing but Buchtel at the time. I mean, we went to all the Buchtel games and all the Buchtel events, the football games, everything, and our minds was going to Buchtel. So, you know, when Drew just made that decision, you know, it was difficult for us, but, you know, when we finally sat down and really came together as friends, we was like, hey, we need to stick together, and, you know, we're going to let you make this call, Drew. We're going to follow you.
Now, you write in your book that some people turned against you when you decided to go to St. Vincent because they thought you were turning your back on the African-American community. Could you describe that period and what your response to that was?
Well, it was difficult. I mean, in the summer of 99, I think that was my freshman year. That summer before, you know, in between eighth grade and ninth grade, you had to you know, even though we had decided to go to St. V, we were still playing in the black community. We were still playing basketball against those same kids and those same adults that really wanted us to come, you know, to Booker. So it was difficult, but I think our friendship and what we had and what Coach Drew was way more powerful than anything anybody else had ever said for us or, you know, about us.
You won the state national championship your senior year. So the bet paid off. The fact that you and your three friends decided to go to St. Vincent together, it paid off. And then, you know, you were an NBA draft. You joined the Cavaliers when they were in last place. I know you're very fond of Cleveland. You grew up in Akron. Why would you want to join a team that was in the last place?
Well, first of all, if you know, I had no choice. You know, that's why it's called a draft. They pick who they want. And,
good point.
things like that. But the fact is, when I was drafted to that team, I felt like I could make an impact. I felt like I could help. You know, they only won 17 games the year before I got drafted. But, you know, I felt like my talents could help that franchise. And, you know, I think the city of Cleveland has some of the best fans that the world has to see. And, you know, I was happy to go into that experience and take my talents to that team also.
I'm sure it was your dream to be in the NBA when you got there. How did it compare to what you expected?
It was everything and more. I always wanted to be in the NBA and have a uniform with my name on the back. They say James across the back of the jersey. And I can remember my first NBA game, which we played in Sacramento. And to just be out there and to see the fans and to see, you know, the cameras and to see my teammates and see the opposing team on the NBA floor in the NBA game, it was like, wow, it was like somebody like, please don't pinch me because I know I'm dreaming.
Now, you know your one-handed full court shot?
Mm-hmm.
How did you develop that?
I don't know. It's just, I guess I'm the chosen one, I guess. I guess Sports Illustrated was right.
There you go. Now, describe the feeling of taking a shot and the ball's like circling around the rim and then like falls out instead of going in.
Well,
and the game's really close.
No, that's happened multiple times. It's not a pleasant feeling, you know, especially when you feel like that was the one. You know, you shoot the ball. All basketball players know when that shot feels great, you know, and then the ball gets on the rim and it plays with the rim and it's like goes in and then it feels like some imaginary hand punches it back out of the net. That's like, it's not a really good feeling at all.
Now, you said that you think what makes your approach to basketball different, like your approach is based on like your mental approach to the game. I'm paraphrasing here, but it was something like that. So what do you mean by that?
That my mental aspect of the game is
mm-hmm.
what?
That's the key to your...
Oh, it is. I mean, I think the game more than I really played. I mean, I can play the game pretty good too, but I really think the game and approach the game mentally more than physically, you know. And you know, that's watching film. That's knowing your opponent's likes and dislikes, his pros and cons, what he like to do, what he don't like to do. Who are we playing against this particular team? You know, what do they like to do? What do they don't like to do? And that's the way I approach the game. I feel like skill-wise, I'm going to be okay. But who's gonna outthink the game more than the next man in front of him?
You know, we've been talking through the interview about the three other friends, teammates who you went to junior high and high school with. What are they doing now?
Well, my four best friends right now, Drew Joyce is playing professionally in Poland. Romeo Travis is playing professionally in Germany. Shion Cotton is playing football at Walsh University in Canton, Ohio, and also in school. And Willie McGee is getting his is going to graduate school at the University of Akron and also working with the men's basketball team.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
LeBron James speaking to Terry Gross last year. More Than a Game, the documentary about his loyalty to his closest childhood friends, is now out on DVD. And James and his Cleveland Cavaliers play tonight in the NBA playoffs in Game 3 against the Boston Celtics. In 2008, Marvel Comics superhero Iron Man came to the screen, starring Robert Downey Jr. as billionaire arms mogul Tony Stark, who wears an iron suit that lets him fly around and zap bad guys. In light of that film's superheroic box office total, Downey and director Jon Favreau are back with Iron Man 2, which also features Mickey Rourke as an electrified villain called Whiplash. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
As I watched Iron Man 2, one phrase went through my head. It's the compliment the male characters paid to one another in director Jon Favreau's first film, Swingers. You're so money. Iron Man 2, you're so money. I don't mean garish or gaudy or without a sense of humor, but in all the superhero leagues in all the world, Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark has the swankiest pad, a cliffside Malibu mansion that would make Bruce Wayne drool with envy. In his cool, low-lit lab, a computer with a smooth British voice supplies his needs, while sexy A-list foils like Gwyneth Paltrow and Scarlett Johansson sashay in and out. Viewers might ask, can money buy a good movie? Not always, but in this case, yes. Iron Man 2 is a smart piece of work. It doesn't have the emotional heft of Superman 2 and Spider-Man 2, those two twos that outclassed their ones. But Favreau and screenwriter Justin Theroux have paced it like a screwball comedy, with fast-talking dames and ping-pong zingers that show off Downey's expert timing. After promoting Paltrow's Pepper Potts to CEO, he needs a new assistant, and Johansson's Natalie Rushman from the legal department looks super promising.
She is from legal, and she is potentially a very expensive sexual harassment lawsuit if you keep ogling her like that. Yes, and I've got three excellent potential candidates that are lined up and ready to meet you.
I don't have time to meet. I need someone now. I feel like it's her.
No, it's not. What, are you going to Google her now?
I thought I was ogling her. Oh, wow. Very, very impressive individual. She's fluent in French, Italian, Russian, Latin. Who speaks Latin?
No one speaks Latin. It's a dead language.
Iron Man 2 does have a plot, and it's functional. It starts where the first film ended, with Stark admitting publicly to being the guy in the iron suit flying around battling baddies. Iron Man peddled a bogus but appealing fantasy that an American from a family that made its fortune selling weapons to kill people in far-off countries could himself become a weapon for peace. So you could, if inclined, applaud the anti-military industrialist complex message, but also cheer for a superhero who's the product of military industrialist ingenuity. Either way, America is so money. At first, Iron Man 2 adds a new wrinkle. Stark gets subpoenaed by a Congress that resents his boast of having, quote, successfully privatized world peace. But his chief Senate antagonist, played by Gary Shandling, turns out to be the puppet of rival, unscrupulous weapons maker Justin Hammer, played by Sam Rockwell, with the perfect ratio of unctuousness to menace. So the politics in the end are moot, and we're left with special effects fighting other special effects. To be fair, they're sensational, and we never lose sight of the characters behind them. Stark has a plug in his chest made from the element palladium that keeps him alive, but is also poisoning him. So his feats are double-edged. The more superheroic, the greater the cost to the superhero. Plus, he's facing off against a Russian supervillain, Mickey Rourke's Ivan Vanko, who has a chip on his shoulder the size of an asteroid. Even in prison, it's clear Vanko has the upper hand. Stark has no idea where Vanko got the technology for his electrified supersuit, or how the two men are linked.
You come from a family of thieves and butchers. And now, like all guilty men, try to rewrite your own history. And you forget all the lives the Stark family has destroyed.
Speaking of thieves, where did you get this design?
My father, Anton Vanko.
Oh, I never heard of him.
My father is the reason you're alive.
The reason I'm alive is because you had a shot you took it you missed.
Did I?
Mickey Rourke's recent reemergence is a beautiful thing, the way Dennis Hopper's was after Blue Velvet. They're actors who entered death spirals of excess and were resurrected, though much the worse for wear, and are equal parts inspiring and scary. As Danko, Rourke sports messy tattoos and a mouthful of metal from which he spits blood, smiling, of course. Decked out as Whiplash, he throws out arms extended by long and lethal electric tendrils. He gives Iron Man 2 a badly needed sting, a glimpse of personal demons, a movie so money can't buy.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.